This has been such an issue over, you know, over the past several years. It started getting more attention. In the past 5 years, maybe, because the fact that they have felony convictions has in most cases barred them from being firefighters. They can't get the EMT license. There was a change in state law that took effect in 2021 that allowed for California firefighters with nonviolent convictions to potentially get those convictions expunged and become firefighters in the free world. And that has happened some. It's not widespread, but it is an option now, and it didn't used to be.
Well, Carrie Blakinger, we thank you so much for being with us. We're going to link to both your Marshall Project piece and your piece in the LA Times, how you can help the incarcerated firefighters battling LA wildfires. Author of the memoir Corrections in Ink, speaking to us from Los Angeles, where she was just recently evacuated. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Ass Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Biden makes last-minute moves to improve relations with Cuba. Federal money helps Portland and Vancouver reconnect neighborhoods separated by freeways. And bus service through northeastern Oregon gets a major downgrade. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 14th, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. President Biden will remove Cuba from the state sponsor of terrorism list just days before he leaves office. He wrote to Congress saying there was no information to support Cuba being on that list. Cuba was listed by the previous Trump administration just days before leaving office. The other countries on that list are North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Cuban officials have pushed for the whole Biden administration to be taken off the list, since being on it means a whole host of economic sanctions. Biden also announced he would waive Title III of the Helms-Burton Act. That allowed U.S. nationals to sue for damages to private property seized during the Cuban Revolution. Now, that's illegal again. It was invoked during the first Trump term. The changes are likely to be well received in the region, but may not last. Trump and his allies are likely to be hard on Cuba, especially Senator Marco Rubio, his pick for Secretary of State. Rubio has long supported measures punishing the island nation. Portland will receive $1 million to study a potential rework of the I-405 ramps in North Portland in the Elliott and Boise neighborhoods. The ramps are overbuilt, according to PBOT, and could be scaled back. They interrupt the street grid near Emmanuel Hospital and disconnect neighborhoods. The ramp and the hospital were built to displace black Portlanders from the historically black neighborhood Albina in the 1960s and 70s through eminent domain. In recent years, transportation and racial justice advocates have pushed governments to right these wrongs by working to reconnect historic Albina and help families who were displaced move back. That has included a plan for freeway caps in the Rose Quarter, where Interstate 5 bisected the neighborhood. The caps have federal funding to cover the freeway and allow construction on top. The I-405 ramp could be shortened by about a block, according to one early plan, reconnecting the street grid and opening up green space. Across the Columbia, in Vancouver, federal officials just approved a $30 million grant to cap Interstate 5 connecting historic Fort Vancouver with downtown. It's planned to be a park and was originally planned over 10 years ago as part of the previous attempt to replace the Interstate Bridge. Washington Representative Marie Gluskamp-Perez said in a statement, quote, "As we build a new I-5 bridge that we take pride in, we have the opportunity to safely and durably connect downtown with the historic Fort Vancouver and its surrounding neighborhoods," end quote. Your last chance to ride a Greyhound bus from Portland to Boise comes tomorrow. Greyhound is canceling routes on the I-84 corridor between Pasco, Washington, and Boise, Idaho. Northeast Oregon stops affected include Ontario, Baker City, LaGrande, and Pendleton. Community Connection of Northeast Oregon does offer transit in Union, Baker, and Wallawa County, and operates the LaGrande Transit Hub, where Greyhound stops. They will continue to offer intercity bus routes. Community Connection said, quote, "There will no longer be a Greyhound stop in LaGrande. Their daily routes through our transit hub will be missed. We are open and have many different ways folks can ride," end quote. The cancellation still eliminates or at least significantly reduces bus transit from Northeast Oregon to Portland and Boise. The Oregon Department of Transportation does expect the cancellation to be disruptive for travelers, and the agency is trying to come up with alternative solutions. Flix North America, the parent company for Greyhound, said they will still operate a shorter route from Portland to Pasco. They also hope to restore broader area routing in the future. Flix is the largest intercity bus travel company in the U.S. Overall, bus ridership is growing across North America, partly because of affordability. The Oregon legislative session will begin next Tuesday on January 21st. A proposed bill would pause Oregon State Retirement Fund's investment in fossil fuels. The PAUSE Act is the latest attempt to move Oregon away from fossil fuels. The bill would introduce a 5-year ban on fossil fuel investments for Oregon's public employee retirement system. Advocates of the bill say divesting in fossil fuels is good for the climate and smart financially, citing poor returns last year. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
A new bill aims to further reduce investments in fossil fuels by Oregon's public employee retirement system. The PAUSE Act would impose a 5-year ban on new investments by the system in private fossil fuel funds. Supporters believe this move will help lower emissions and keep wealth in Oregon communities. Andrew Bogrand with Divest Oregon helped draft the bill. The group found that PERS fossil fuel investments have underperformed the market by $4 to $10 billion over the past decade.
Private equity has taken advantage, in our view, of public pensions, and this would allow Treasury staff the time and space they need to kind of course correct.
Last year, former Treasurer Tobias Reed, now Secretary of State, introduced a plan to reduce PERS investments in fossil fuels by 60% by 2035, aiming for net zero emissions by 2050. Bogrand says the PAUSE Act aligns with that plan. Oregon PERS covers pensions for more than 415,000 public employees across schools, local governments, and 900 agencies. Divest Oregon says 60% of PERS funds are private investments, which is almost double the average U.S. pension fund. Oregon's treasurer, the newly sworn-in Elizabeth Steiner, manages the PERS investments, totaling more than $100 billion. Steiner says moving away from fossil fuels is not just about reducing emissions. It's smart financially.
The data are really clear that carbon-intensive investments are a risky proposition at this point, and that at some point in the not-too-distant future, they will not be profitable.
Steiner says it is too soon to say if she can support the PAUSE Act, but she is having productive conversations with Divest Oregon. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Republicans want to attach strings to California fire aid. A judge clears the release of findings about Trump election interference. And North Carolina Republicans seek to invalidate tens of thousands of votes in the state's Supreme Court race. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. I expect that there will be strings attached to money that is ultimately approved, and it has to do with being ready the next time, because this was a gross failure this time.
Wyoming Republican John Barrasso says California must meet requirements before Congress will send disaster aid. The coal state senator did not blame climate change, but says liberal diversity policies hampered fighting the fires that have destroyed more than 10,000 homes and businesses. California fire officials say the water infrastructure was just not built for urban fires of this size. A federal judge says the Justice Department can release special counsel Jack Smith's report on President-elect Donald Trump's 2020 election interference. Trump's lawyers may appeal to the Supreme Court, but Smith says the public should know that the January 6th insurrection was fueled by lies.
Lies by the defendant targeted at obstructing a bedrock function of the U.S. government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election.
A Friday hearing will determine if the department can release separate findings in Trump's classified documents case. Both cases were closed because Justice Department policy says no sitting president can face charges. Repeated recounts in a North Carolina Supreme Court race have shown the Democrat winning by a few hundred votes, but the Republican is suing to invalidate about 60,000 ballots. As of now, the current state Supreme Court is blocking the Board of Elections from certifying the race. Former Governor Roy Cooper says these kinds of anti-democratic challenges could become the norm.
This is a scheme to throw out legal votes en masse by eligible voters who even showed their voter ID to be able to vote.
According to media reports, the Republican is challenging the ballots of black voters at twice the rate of white voters. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance is walking back Trump's promise to issue near-blanket pardons of January 6th rioters. He tells Fox News some violent protesters may not deserve release.
If you committed violence on that day, obviously you shouldn't be pardoned. And there's a little bit of a gray area there, but we're very much committed to seeing the equal administration of law.
The mixed messages have angered some supporters who say if Trump avoided jail, those who rallied for him should too. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has called a special legislative session to prepare for mass migrant deportations, but lawmakers from both parties, including Democratic Representative Fantrice Driscoll, says that's premature.
Is the Florida Guard going to start removing students from college? Are they going to start breaking up families? I mean, we need to think about what the implications of these policies are.
DeSantis has vowed to suspend any elected officials who don't help with the new immigration policies. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Melissa Melko, one of the organizers of the annual North American Rewilding Conference coming up on January 24th. At 6, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1911, Roald Amundsen's South Pole expedition makes landfall on the eastern edge of the Ross Ice Shelf. The quote of the day is from Alsatian philosopher Albert Schweitzer, who said, quote, "The only way out of today's misery is for people to become worthy of each other's trust." As the wildfires in Los Angeles continue to burn, with red flag wind warnings lasting through Wednesday, the local Native community is coming together to support those who have been affected. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the Native community in Los Angeles gathered Monday evening for a prayer and healing circle as wildfires continue to burn in Southern California. The gathering at United American Indian Involvement was intended to bring people together and raise awareness about the resources being provided to those in need by the Urban Indian Organization. It has set up an emergency response center. Among efforts, the organization is providing temporary shelter, coordinating housing and transportation, and distributing emergency supplies to those impacted by the fires. The organization held a press conference before the gathering. UAII board member Laura Escobar says, among challenges, they're hearing from Native community members in fire zones, there are power outages, people are being unable to leave secure areas, and not being able to get necessities like food and water. Elder and board member Keith Bell says their effort is what community is all about. Even though they may be far away from their reservations, they have Native values and traditional ways, which include helping one another. They're also offering hotel accommodations and meals and working on long-term plans to offer assistance after the fires. The organization is accepting donations and has a telephone helpline for those impacted by the wildfires. According to the United American Indian Involvement, it serves a large urban Native population with more than 200,000 Native people living in LA County. Neighboring tribes are among those offering support to fight the wildfires. The San Manuel Band of Mission Indians in San Bernardino County says, as its neighbors face overwhelming challenges of the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles County, the tribe is responding to mutual aid requests. It sent the San Manuel Fire Department to the Eaton Fire to help battle the blaze. In a statement, the tribe says during this difficult time, the tribe stands united with the courageous first responders, fully committed to help safeguard homes, loved ones, and the spirit of community. Other California tribes and tribes across the country have sent fire trucks and crews to battle the wildfires. Nomination hearings for President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet are scheduled to begin this week. Tribal leaders from across the country are closely watching and are preparing for the incoming administration. Discussions took place at the Biden administration's final White House Tribal Nations Summit last month in Washington. Tribal leaders also talked about the transition at a U.S. Department of Justice tribal consultation held in Santa Fe, New Mexico, leading up to the White House summit. Leaders like Mark Mitchell with the Pueblo of Tizuque say, regardless of which political party is in office, tribal treaty and trust responsibilities need to be kept. He says the work of tribal leaders includes advocating for Native American issues and concerns, and for his tribe in New Mexico, that includes environmental and sacred site protection.
How do we bridge the gap? How can we educate them, the incoming administration, as to their foresight? Because right now, I don't think they're looking at that. We understand the issue of having funding and relying on natural resources, etc. But at what cost to the tribes? You know, those are some of the questions we're asking internally. So hopefully we come up with a strategic plan to address those issues as we move forward.
Mitchell says as the process for selecting the cabinet moves forward, he hopes there's insight into Indian country.
I hope they have some type of Native person on there advising them that, you know, hey, this is another route we can secure, you know, and address the issues of the Native communities. And I hope they're doing that. And I haven't seen anything as of yet, but I sure hope they're doing that.
Senate hearings for nominees are scheduled to begin Tuesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The fantasy role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons is now 50 years old, and one Colorado State University instructor suggests that today's political leaders could learn a lot by rolling the dice. Eric Galatas has the story.
As the popular role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons turns 50, one Colorado State University instructor suggests that today's political leaders could learn a lot by rolling the dice. James Fielder calls the game a master class in political strategy, covering everything from diplomacy to alliance forming to conflict resolution. Fielder says players have to work together to achieve a goal. If you're at odds with each other, you don't achieve anything.
So the lesson is that we're learning to negotiate in order to overcome a challenge, and that lesson sticks. You come out of the table, oh, I learned how to negotiate with other people, and we overcame a challenge. It worked.
A former Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, Fielder has more than two decades of experience designing war games and training exercises. He says role-playing is not just child's play. He compares the games to a ritual performance. When players are inside a game space, which could be a football field, a card table, or war room, everything inside the game is very real, including wins, losses, and lessons learned about the use of power. power. Fielder says when a dungeon master reveals an unintended consequence of the player's decisions, for example, the massacre of an entire town, they frequently look at each other like, what did we just do?
You will also find players who will play evil characters, carry out atrocities in the game, but then when they come out, they don't feel good about themselves. They feel unclean, like, oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. And so, yes, that sends a very powerful message.
Fielder says even in today's modern age, games can be similar to an animist rite of passage where participants believe that a spiritual leader wearing an animal's skin is an actual god or animal.
Well, if you're wearing a suit to go to work, you're wearing the skin of a business person. I was in the military for 25 years, putting on the uniform. I'm wearing the skin of a sergeant or a lieutenant colonel.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
A church in Georgia is harnessing clean energy to serve its community during emergencies with a new solar-powered resiliency hub. The project offers a lifeline for neighbors in need while showcasing the potential of climate-focused solutions. Shantia Hudson has the details.
An Atlanta church is stepping up to keep the lights on and support its community during climate emergencies. The Community Church of Atlanta has been serving its neighbors through weekly food pantries, blood drives, and low-cost health checks. Now, with the new Vickers Community Center, Pastor Kevin Early says they'll be able to provide critical emergency services for those without a backup plan when disaster strikes.
We will be able to keep that building open for several weeks, even if it's out in the homes of our neighbors, giving them a chance to come and charge their cell phones, receive communications from the city and abroad, refrigerate breast milk and medication, food, and water.
From 2000 to 2023, extreme weather caused 83 major power outages in Georgia, according to the Research and Communications Group Climate Central. Early says the Resilience Hub at the church's community center became a reality thanks to the clean energy nonprofit Groundswell, which helped secure funding from the Inflation Reduction Act to install solar panels and battery storage. He hopes this project inspires other churches to adopt clean energy solutions, showing how they can strengthen their communities while being more resilient during emergencies.
We are certainly believing that we might have a ripple effect, that congregations will see that they can make a difference, make an impact in their neighborhood during weather-related emergencies. At the same time, reduce emissions.
In addition to cutting emissions, Early says the church is also saving on energy cost. While the Inflation Reduction Act has been key in funding projects like this, clean energy advocates are raising concerns about the program's future as new leadership takes office in Washington. They warn that cutting these tax credits could limit opportunities for underserved communities. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson. This story was produced with original reporting from Yesenia Funes with Next City and Yale Climate Connections.
Donald Trump is set to be inaugurated on Monday, and already his cabinet picks are facing confirmation hearings in Congress. As one commentator notes, Trump's nominees for positions involving foreign affairs are people with dubious qualifications. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. This two-part commentary starts by looking at nominees who are major campaign donors and supreme loyalists. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In this two-part commentary, I want to focus on nominees for top positions in the Trump administration who are going to be involved in foreign policy making. These people can be divided into three groups: super-rich donors to Trump's campaign who have bought their way into an official position, supreme loyalists whose chief qualification is subservience to Trump, and members of Trump's extended family. So far as I can tell, none of these people puts devotion to the rule of law, the Constitution, and the public interest above personal gain and support of strongman rule. In the first category, the big-time donors are around nine people so far who have donated at least $1 million to Trump's campaign and have been rewarded with top-level jobs. Elon Musk comes first with donations of over $262 million. He's followed by Linda McMahon, nominated for Secretary of Education, who has donated over $21 million. Howard Lutnick, nominee for Secretary of Commerce, is third with over $9 million. The other six have donated around $3 million or less, and they include two ambassadors, Treasury Secretary and Undersecretary of State, the head of the Small Business Administration, and a Deputy Secretary of Defense. Musk hardly needs an introduction. He's essentially second president, though he's never been elected to anything. Like Trump, Musk is a security risk in two respects. First, his status as a private Trump benefactor who regularly and forcefully speaks out on public affairs raises serious questions. Does Musk speak for Trump? Is Musk a U.S. official who can be held accountable for his actions? Musk speaks with foreign leaders and comments on politics abroad with increasing regularity. Is what he says U.S. policy? When, for example, he says that the far-right neo-Nazi AfD party in Germany is that country's savior, will that be the official position of the Trump administration? Or when Musk speaks with Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban of Hungary, will Musk be offering his personal views or Trump's? And is there a risk that Musk will share classified information with them? Among the several nominees who are distinguished by their absolute loyalty to Trump are Kash Patel, slated to be FBI director in place of Christopher Wray. If Patel follows through on his many threats to former officials, Wray will be among the victims of Trumpian retribution. Michelle Goldberg succinctly describes Patel in the New York Times, quote, a thuggish lackey who has spent years fantasizing about taking revenge on Trump's enemies. Who are those enemies? Patel's 2023 book called Government Gangsters provides 60 names, most of them familiar. It seems crystal clear that Patel is a prototype of the Soviet-era NKVD inspector who delights in sending people to the gulag. Pete Hegseth, another loyalist, has been nominated for Secretary of Defense. By now we're all familiar with his sordid background, outrageous behavior toward women, drunkenness on the job, terrible administration at the Veterans Administration. Of course, he's in total denial. He's a changed man, we're assured. But even if we give him a pass on his behavior, we have to consider his views of the military, woke, and victim of poisonous ideologies such as gender parity and adaptation to climate change, and his foreign policy views. He sees NATO as merely a U.S.-funded defense system, not an alliance. Turkey as Islamist and therefore unsuitable for NATO membership. The United Nations as anti-American, and the Geneva Convention as something that should not apply to U.S. soldiers. Tulsi Gabbard, another loyalist, has pro-Russian views and contempt for human rights. She apparently believes the war in Ukraine is America's fault, which puts her in good company with Russian propagandists. Her secretive meetings with Syria's dictator Bashar al-Assad in 2017 seem to have been motivated at improving his image in the U.S. Now that Assad is a resident of Moscow, does Gabbard still believe he's the victim of a bad press? Oh, this person could do the job of Director of National Intelligence, which involves oversight of 18 agencies, it defies imagination. Richard Grenell was Trump's ambassador to Germany and acting Director of National Intelligence. Now Trump says he'll be performing special missions, working in some of the hottest spots around the world, including Venezuela and North Korea. Grenell led the effort to overturn the 2020 vote in Nevada. More recently, he hooked up with Jared Kushner to land hotel projects in the Balkans. Peter Navarro, slated to be Trump's senior counselor for trade and manufacturing, was found in contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over documents in the January 6th committee hearings. And finally, we have Michael Duffy, who distinguished himself in the first Trump administration by pushing for withholding aid to Ukraine until President Zelensky agreed to investigate Joe Biden. Duffy is nominated for a Pentagon position. In part two next week, I'll talk about Trump's extended family. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 14th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, David Rosenberg, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Isabel Charlet, Shantia Hudson, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Melissa Melko from Rewild Portland to talk about the upcoming annual North American Rewilding Conference from January 24th through the 26th at the Bridge Space Commons in Portland. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So for folks who aren't familiar with this event, what is the annual North American Rewilding Conference?
This is a time of year during this kind of slow winter introspection season that we get people together, individuals, groups, grassroots organizations, all people who are working to restore ecosystems and importantly, humans' place in them, and people who see humans as kind of woven in and connected part of nature, not separate from it, and talk about human history, what's happening in the environment right now, and kind of what all we can do about it together.
What does rewilding mean exactly?
Well, my favorite definition of it is living in community with your ecological place, kind of the idea of, like, regardless of where we come from, our ancestors come from, like, wherever we're living now, like, how can we be good stewards there? And how can we, like, reconnect to the wildness, the autonomy in ourselves and in our communities in a good way?
Well, the theme of this year's conference is subsistence and resistance. What can you tell me about that theme? Like, why was it chosen?
Subsistence as resistance has become our kind of perennial theme, and it is about trying to reclaim autonomy in our communities and see, you know, outside of the, you know, destructive forces of consumerism and capitalism, like, how can we work together to meet the needs of people and in our communities with all of the resources and skills and imagination that we have, like, right where we are.
What does that look like in the past, in years past, for this conference, this reclaiming of autonomy?
Well, we have had so many amazing speakers come over the years. And the cool thing about the conference is that we inv-